So while our executive officer makes notes, you know, our next item, item 11, will be providing the Eastern Sandwich River Watershed Agriculture Order update. So could you please introduce the speakers?
Thank you for stretching for me there. I appreciate it. Can't write that fast sometimes. Item 11 is an informational item on the State Water Board's Eastern San Joaquin Agricultural General Order, also called shorthand ESJ, or the ESJ Order. Recall that the ESJ Order is the State Water Board's order adopted in February 2018, so just this February, in response to petitions filed against the Central Valley Regional Board's Ag Order for the Eastern San Joaquin River Watershed. The State Water Board's order is important to this region because it contains precedential requirements that all regional board irrigated lands programs are expected to incorporate into their forthcoming ag orders. This includes our own 4.0, for which we are currently developing options. Ms. M.L. Wadwani, Assistant Chief Counsel for the regional boards in the Office of Chief Counsel at State Board, played a lead role in the legal review and development of the ESJ order. Ms. Wadwani is here to present a high-level summary of the background and precedential components of the ESJ order. And I also want to acknowledge that our State Water Board liaison, Didi Diadamo, wanted to thank her. She was instrumental in connecting us on this item.
Good afternoon, Board Chair Wolf and board members. This is Annelle Wadwani with the Office of Chief Counsel, and I'm here with Darren Polhamus, who's the Deputy Director of the Division of Drinking Water. I think John already indicated that, just to give some context for why we're presenting this, I was the lead attorney assigned to the petition review in this case, and Darren was the technical advisor who advised the board on the technical aspects of the order. This is on, right? You guys can hear me? Okay. And we're presenting a pretty broad overview of the order at this point. It's some 90 pages long with a few hundred pages of attachments. It's pretty detailed and complicated, but we're going to try to capture the main points of the order. So this is a petition order adopted by the State Water Board in February. It reviewed the petitions, I should say, were challenging a 2012 Central Valley Water Board agricultural order that applied to the Eastern San Joaquin Coalition. The Eastern San Joaquin permit is one of several third-generation permits that the Central Valley Board issued between about 2012 and 2015 that addressed for the first time groundwater impacts in addition to surface water impacts, and that's part of the significance of these orders and the significance of the challenges. The Eastern San Joaquin permit was the first one issued and was the first one that came before the State Board as a petition. It's important to point out that in the end, the review conducted by the State Board, you can see it took a little over 5 years, I think, 5 years and 2 months, and part of the reason for that was, I'll explain some of the process that we went through, but the petition, the order, the review, the process ended up being significantly broader than just looking at the issues that were raised in the petitions. The State Board took up a number of issues on its own motion and viewed this as an opportunity to set some statewide precedent for addressing, in particular, groundwater impacts from irrigated agriculture. Why is the petition order relevant to the Central Coast region? I just wanted to explain why we're presenting it here. So it is precedential. The State Board's findings in this order and direction in this order are precedential statewide. So it includes, obviously that includes the Central Coast region. The order specifically states that all regional water boards will update, renew, reissue their permits within 5 years of the issuance of this order to incorporate the precedential aspects of the order. And it's also very significant because it is one of the first not the first, and I'll explain why not the first, but some of the primary direction that the State Board is giving on how we should be thinking about accounting for and minimizing some of the nitrogen that is applied to agriculture fields if it has the potential to reach drinking water. This is not really a, I wouldn't want to put it out as a legal statement. It's a very simplified version of what we think about when we think about the non-point source policy, which this order implements, and the process we want to think about in terms of understanding what some of our requirements are. In the non-point source context, we often rely on management practices and implementation of management practices for improvements in water quality. We, however, continue to have a legal obligation to meet the water quality outcomes that we're supposed to meet under the Water Code. And one of the significant aspects of how we think about this is that we need monitoring and reporting, what the non-point source policy calls a feedback mechanism, to tie the management practices that are being implemented through the permit with the water quality requirements that the order has. Another significant aspect, and that's the second arrow, is that if those water quality requirements are not being met as a result of what's being done through management practices, we need to be able to communicate back to the growers what improved management practices need to be implemented. So to provide additional background, it was actually the Central Coast, what I think you've been calling the 2.0 order, that was first challenged to the State Water Board as an order with aspects that had groundwater issues. And in that particular review, the State Water Board considered a number of the requirements in the Central Coast order, and in particular, reporting of nitrogen applied to the fields and the sampling of on-farm drinking water supply wells to test for nitrates. There were two of the main issues that the State Board considered. The State Board at the time indicated that it gave direction, but also indicated that there was an ongoing process that had been triggered by the UC Davis study, nitrate study, for review and evaluation of these issues, and that it would at some point review those processes and studies and come back with further guidance. As you know, this particular order is still in litigation, and we don't have, Steve just mentioned it, oral argument is scheduled. We're waiting for the Court of Appeal to make a determination in that litigation. But as that order has been kind of proceeding through the courts, we've also had a process for thinking about some of the issues that the State Board addressed in that. The 2012 UC Davis nitrate report that I mentioned, the State Water Board reported to the legislature, made a couple of suggestions that are relevant here. One is to for the convening of a nitrogen tracking task force that was led by CDFA and looked at issues related to how we should be tracking nitrogen application in the irrigated lands context, and an agricultural expert panel that was led by State Board. In both cases, a number of organizations were involved in the process that was to issue recommendations on nitrogen management. So that process was proceeding at the same time that the State Board actually had the petitions on the East San Joaquin order. So rather than address the East San Joaquin petitions immediately, the State Board actually delayed review, and that's part of the five-year time frame that it took State Board to issue a decision. The State Board delayed those proceedings in order to benefit from some of the expert recommendations through this process. Okay, I'm going to turn it over to Darren for a little while to talk about some of the issues, the technical issues that frame this discussion.
Good afternoon. So Dan Bogans. This is a map. It's actually pretty old data, but you need to just put more dots on it in the same area if we were to update it. It basically expresses areas of the state that are above the MCL for nitrate in drinking water. And as you can see, there's extensive parts of the Central Coast, the Central Valley, and other agricultural areas that are impacted. If you don't know, give me the clicker. Thank you. This is the same thing. It just now extends it to, if it's one half of the MCL, it extends the extent of the dots. I often use these slides just to present when I get asked of, you know, why are we addressing groundwater in agricultural type contexts. And usually I say, because I'm talking to agricultural clouds, it's because it's your water that you're drinking. Yeah.
Thank you. Sorry for the interruption. What does it mean when you say 11,431 miles above one half the maximum contaminant level?
Yeah.
One half.
So that would be 5 parts per million of nitrate. Yeah. We wanted to show people there are those that are already exceeding the standard, and then those that are likely on their way to exceeding it, or at a half level where you start to get worried. Okay, so in contemplating managing nitrogen in the agricultural order context, there's some real challenges. Certainly, we always prefer a direct measurement of anything we do when we have that opportunity. A non-point source usually confounds that, and I would say discharges in the bottom of agricultural fields makes it near impossible to really have any direct measurement. There's been some attempts, but you know, on a broad scale across the landscape, it would become beyond our means to address that. So without that, in the non-point source context, we always refer them to developing management practices. In the other context, again, that gets super complicated because they're interrelated. Almost any management practice you impose in an agricultural context then has the corollaries that come along with it. What kind of irrigation system you have, the soil types you are, the varieties of crops you're growing, it goes on and on. And there's a very complex mix of it. So it's not a simple, and not implying that stormwater is necessarily simple, but in any context, stormwater, you know, there's a BMP that works for that scenario. And, you know, we can go inspect it, we can see it and say it's implied, and therefore, you know, we can presume then that we've addressed the potential discharges from that. And I think in agricultural context, that is really problematic. And I want to be very clear that we never, those that wanted to try to find the best management practice, or maybe even the page of best management practices that they thought they could apply, I just never felt, and I think our expert panels concurred, that ever was going to be in the cards. So it wasn't ever going to be a short list. It's that. So we're compounded with that. So what we've been facing and what the Ag Expert panel brought to us was, you know, we can do other types of measurements. An efficiency measurement that then acts as a proxy for direct measurement and can give you an indication as to how the suite of management practices being deployed on particular acres are performing. Some of them will be fantastic, some of them will need improvement, and if we go for that measurement, then we have a chance of trying to do that. So that's kind of the underlying concept. This is a graphic I stole off of the internet that is one of the many complex showings of the nitrogen, field nitrogen in an agricultural or environmental setting. And you can see there's a lot of boxes, there's multiple inputs, there's places that nitrogen becomes stored in the crop material and the soil and all kinds of things. And people often face this and, like, you know, took their hands and said, look, it's too complex, I can't figure out where nitrogen is, you know, at any one time and create a snapshot. And I believe that's a correct statement. But the expert panel that we work with kind of took a step back and kind of saw the whole outside box, and so I created my own version of the graphic, oops, too many clicks, where we can diagnose this down to just the inputs coming in from the left of nitrogen into the field, through the fertilizer applied, to the irrigation water, and any organic amendments that are brought in as being the main sources. Sitting in my audience earlier, I realized that I left off one really tiny input, which would almost be hard to measure, but something that challenged me on this later if I don't mention it, and that is that there is some aerial deposition of nitrogen, but it's minuscule. The arrow would be so thin you wouldn't see it. So I'm going to claim that. It's there, but you can't see it. So in the field, if we look at our losses, we have a loss to atmosphere, we have what we remove in the harvested material, and you have potential soil erosion, which generally in California tends to be small in most instances broadly. And then, of course, we have any nitrogen carried through the deep percolation below the root zone, below the field. And that is obviously our concern. That water, once it's lost control below the root zone, is on its way to the groundwater. Now, it could take a long time or a short time, and that becomes another complexity associated with it. But when we simplify this down by not being concerned necessarily with where the nitrogen is within that box and creating this free body diagram approach, and then expressing it over multiple years so that we have some things that average out that we can drop from the complexity, we arrive at what would be a reasonable efficiency measure. And we expressed it this way as tracking the nitrogen applied and the removed values, and we do two different metrics of that. We create it as a ratio of applied over removed, which then gives you a unitless ratio that can be used in comparison purposes. But you lose the magnitude when you do that. And the reason that's important oftentimes is if you're dealing with some crops that are really low in nitrogen usage and you get a wonderful or a poor ratio, that has different impacts than if you're dealing with a crop that has high usage and has a poor or a wonderful. So it's really important to have both those numbers. So then the A minus R does give you the magnitude of the nitrogen left behind. And these numbers here, it's not shown on the slide, but keep in mind that we're talking about a minimum of a three-year applied and a three-year removed to account for some of the variables that happen. You know, 1 year a farmer gets called and says, disc under the melons, I'm not buying. All that nitrogen stayed in the field. If you were looking at a single-year AR, you get a really weird spike. If you stretch that and include the 3 years, the year before and the year after you had that call, then you start to get a better approach as to really what's going on, approach with that. So this would be the representation of my graphic again. You can see where the A and the R are. Those are all importantly measurable values as well. We can measure those that are actively measured or estimated in a reasonable, accurate way that would lend itself to being useful. And so this AR ratio we create both ends up being an efficiency measure and also has value as a management practice in and of itself.
So I am going to try to summarize kind of the major components of the order now in terms of how this knowledge that came from the petition process, but also from the Nitrogen Tracking Task Force and the expert panel was then incorporated into the order from the State Board. So one of the first things, and you'll note that I'm focusing mostly on nitrogen management issues. The order is a little broader than that. At the end, I'll touch on a few other requirements, but we'll start with nitrogen management. So one of the things that came out of the expert panel report was that all growers should be preparing what we're calling irrigation and nitrogen management plans. So it shouldn't be tiered, it shouldn't be based on vulnerability, that any nitrogen applied at some point is likely to reach groundwater, and that it's very important that this requirement be universal for the growers, and that irrigation management be a component of those orders, of those plans. So one of the things that the order allows some discretion on for a regional board is whether or not those irrigation nitrogen management plans should be certified. In the case of the East San Joaquin order, San Joaquin Coalition's order, the high vulnerability are certified, the low vulnerability are not, unless they turn out to be outliers and then they get certification, yes.
Can you define certification?
So certification is one of two things. It's either a professional who has the knowledge certifying, saying that this particular plan has been prepared with, and there's a very specific language, and I was going to talk about actually the presidential language for that, but it's a declaration that the plan has been prepared according to the best knowledge of the certifier, and that it represents the agronomic, an application rate that meets the agronomic needs of the crop while minimizing discharge to groundwater, discharge below the root zone, I think. The certification language itself is actually precedential and will be used by all the regional boards. That language is laid out, the full language is actually laid out in the order. And the purpose for that was to address some of the concerns with liability for a certifier and some of the concerns with the availability of insurance for the certifiers. So it clarifies that the certification doesn't lead to an environmental liability.
Let me add a color commentary here. So the irrigation component is added. The Region 5 order had nitrogen management planning, and we added irrigation. Largely out of the concept that nitrogen doesn't move without water. It would just sit there all day long if water wasn't part of the process. And so they're integrally linked. And as I mentioned before, the management practices, your irrigation management practices are just as important in your nitrogen management as probably any other ones associated with it. So we felt it important to add that.
And one more thing, which is there is a self-certification option. So a grower can attend training to self-certify, and that helps with some of the costs of certification for growers to do that.
Does this requirement, this precedential requirement for irrigation and nitrogen management plan, is there any exception for based on scale for small growers or anything like that?
Yeah, we'll touch on a few exceptions for all of the nitrogen management requirements. And I think it's two slides from now, so if it's okay, I'll wait until we get there. Okay. Another requirement is that the growers shall, from the nitrogen the irrigation nitrogen management plans compile a certain set of data that needs to be reported to the coalition, if there's a coalition, or to the regional board, if it's direct regulation. But the reporting of these values of nitrogen applied and removed values applies to all growers. So all growers are going to be reporting these values. Again, the exceptions would apply in this case, and I'll get to those. So a couple of things to mention here. Dan mentioned that these are multi-year values that we're going to be calculating. There are obviously, Central Coast is an area where there's multiple rotations within a year. So some of the values that are analyzed can be, rather than multi-year, multi-rotation, if you can get to three or four rotations. But the important thing is that when they're analyzed, they be analyzed for several cycles, whether that's year or rotation. The other thing that's important is that these are reported at a field level. So the definition of field becomes pretty important when you're saying it's going to be reported at a field level. The term field comes from the language that's used in the East San Joaquin Order, but it can be any unit that the regional board determines is appropriate, as long as several things are met. So it needs to be the same type of crop, the same management practices and irrigation management practices, and the same fertilizer inputs, generally. The order also allows for the regional, gives the regional board some discretion to determine that there an alternative reporting unit is appropriate, and that might be, for example, in situations where there's multiple crop rotations, complicated set of management practices. There are a couple of parameters there, and Darren, you might want to chime in on this, but whatever that reporting unit ends up being, it cannot be more than 640 acres. And once the reporting is being broken down, it still has to be broken down by crop type when that's reported to the regional board. Anything you wanted to add?
We added that in consideration of some of the complexities of the Central Coast growers that have fast cycles and multiple plantings in what they would consider a field, and dealing with that approach there. I will add one other thing, though, just to point out a distinction. So in the Central Coast order that the board had before, I think your 2.0 version, as it's referenced, had applied nitrogen, and it had an uptake value. And in essence, In that petition, we removed the uptake value from your order, and then now in this order, the removed in regards takes similarly the place of the concept that was applied there. So it's similar, but distinctly different.
More on extra management. So the San Joaquin order, again, was an order that applied to a coalition. And as part of the nitrogen management provisions, a proposal was developed by a group of coalition representatives and environmental justice representatives with regard to how the reporting would occur. And the part of this proposal was that the reporting from the coalition to the regional board would be with identifiers, anonymous identifiers, rather than by naming a name and a location. So the actual, each field still gets a unique identifier, but the identifier is not the name of the grower or the specific location of that field. So I wanted to mention this in this context. In the Central Coast, currently the coalition takes the two coalitions, I think, take on a more limited role, and they're not involved in reporting from the growers to the regional board of nitrogen data. So in that case, the state board's order acknowledged that the data would go directly to the regional board with the names and locations because there's not an intermediary. I may get back to, at the end, a little bit to some of the state board discussion and direction on coalitions versus direct regulation, but I just wanted to point that out here for now. Okay, now the exceptions. So the nitrogen reporting, the whole package of nitrogen reporting, the irrigation and nitrogen management plans and the actual reporting of the ANR values is not precedential only in a very limited context. And this is the language in the order, more or less. It's not precedential where a category of growers affirmatively demonstrates that applied nitrogen is not expected to seep below the root zone in amounts that could impact groundwater and is not expected to discharge to surface water. That's a demonstration that a group of growers or maybe a geographical area would have to make to the regional board. Currently, I believe the rice growers are the only group that have made this demonstration, and that would exempt them from the nitrogen reporting requirements. There are other limited or delayed nitrogen reporting for some categories of growers. So this doesn't get them. This doesn't mean that they're not doing the reporting. It's just that it allows them either more time to report or allows them in some cases not to report the removed component, which can be difficult to calculate. And I'm going to read off those exceptions so I don't get it wrong. So it's growers in areas with no or very limited nitrogen inputs who have minimal nitrogen impacts, who have minimal nitrogen inputs, and who have difficulty measuring yield. And the example provided in the order for this that category would be irrigated pasture. A second category is diversified socially disadvantaged growers. That's a term actually defined in statute. Such growers, if they have total acreage less than 45 and an annual income of less than 350,000 and a crop diversity of 0.5 crops per acre or more, are given additional time to start reporting nitrogen removed. And this was an issue that was brought up by the UC Extensions, and they're working directly with some of these growers to develop possibly an alternative to nitrogen removed. And then the final category is growers, essentially small growers with multiple rotations throughout the year. It's a maximum acreage of 20 with a crop diversity of 0.5 per acres or more. They're given additional time to begin the process of reporting nitrogen removed. In all cases, they would continue to report nitrogen applied, just as the nitrogen removed component that is a little bit more difficult to calculate.
Well, was there any discussion of, you know, instead of looking at a category of growers, looking at category of crop types?
For
in the non-presidential
you know, was that?
Yeah, so actually the concepts, the reason the exemptions were granted were, often called truck farmer type components, where they've got a huge vegetable garden, they're growing it for farmers market sales or other things like that. They've got continuous harvest going on. So it was kind of the opposite. It was not specific crops. It was, they got 50 or 60 different things going on a smaller plot, and it becomes impossible then to track how much they're selling and what's being removed really in nitrogen. And so there's, you know, some work that'll be done to try to come up with some averaging amount that would be guidance to them.
But you just use the example of the rice growers, pursuing that exemption. That is clearly crop-based, not growers-based.
Yeah, that's largely from the extent of, so the rice growers have their own coalition. It's a crop-specific coalition in and of itself. And obviously their growing conditions are such that they're heavy soils, they hold water on the fields. And, you know, they did a bunch of work to show that, you know, when you apply nitrogen, they certainly apply nitrogen, that it actually never converts out of the anhydrous state. It stays as ammonium in the soil because of the redox potential of the flooded environment, and so it's not leaching. Even if there was water moving down, the nitrogen itself remains immobile in the soil for the plants to take up. And so they did a whole bunch of scientific studies as well as monitoring. And, you know, they hold their water and don't discharge it. So they made a demonstration. I think that's more just the ones that did it. That wouldn't preclude someone to come up with another construct that was multiple crops that could meet the exemption. But to be honest, I have not seen any yet that present themselves in that fashion.
So then, let's say, hypothetically, you have another commodity group and coalition who would like to pursue this. Is this done an application to the state board, or is it the application goes to the regional board?
I think we said regional
board. Yeah, the regional board that has to make the determination within the constructs that we provided in the very simple test here, which is that, you know, there's no nitrogen leaving and there's no groundwater impacts that are being shown.
Okay, thank you for the clarification.
The order also provides some direction on how the data should be used once the regional board has the data. So what one use of the data is that the regional water boards are expected to ensure that appropriate follow-up is conducted and responsive management practices are implemented. So if there are outliers, for example, for the A over R ratio or the A minus R difference, in the coalition structure, the coalition is expected to follow up with the growers and disseminate, you know, work with them, improve management practices. In the regional board, if the regional board is directly regulating, then it's the regional board staff that would be expected to carry out that function. And again, I'm going to get back to that a little bit at the end, but let me move on to the second one now. So the regional boards may also correlate and analyze management practice implementation data that they're getting and with the nitrogen application data, and that's a way of starting to identify effective management practices. We haven't touched on that yet, but the order also requires the reporting of management practices by all the growers on a 5-year time frame for some and a more frequent time frame for others. And in the coalition structure, those are coming in with identifiers, but you can link the identifiers and determine how the management practices and the nitrogen application data relate to each other. In the regional board, in this board's context, if you have, you could directly tie those data sets to each other. And here are two ways in which the nitrogen data is expected to be used that is being developed and is not actually part of the process quite yet, but there's a schedule and a process set out in the order for these to happen. So one is that the regional water boards are going to be expected to approve what we're calling groundwater protection targets for nitrogen loading within high priority townships or some geographical unit that the regional board determines is appropriate. The idea there is to look for values, targets for nitrogen loading that would represent the appropriate amount to lead to compliance with the receiving water limitations. There's a public process set up for this in the order. I don't remember the exact timeline, but it's within 2 or 3 years, a proposal is coming back to this to look at whether these targets, how these targets should be developed, and it's expected to go through a public process for its evaluation. Similarly, the regional water boards are directed to evaluate the field level data that they're getting on the A values, the R values, the A over the multi-year A over R values, and A minus R values, and think about, determine whether they those can be understood in terms of kind of acceptable ranges for different groups. This, again, very preliminary. There's some direction in the order for this process to begin, but it will have to go through a public process, come back to the regional board and the state board, and there's, at this point, the A over R ratio target values are not anything other than kind of target values that can be developed and a process for developing them.
Quick question.
Yep.
On those two things on the last slide, the regional boards approving groundwater protection targets and
yep.
And acceptable ranges for the AR ratio target values. I'm a little confused as to, is that going to be separate processes by all the regional boards and one by the state board, or how is that going to work?
I have to go back to the order to see.
Yeah,
so
the,
was, do you remember that?
Yeah, I do. The township groundwater protection targets, the groundwater protection targets for the geographic area would be done between the regional board at the regional board level. I mean, they're obviously for your geographic area. We did set up and try to make it such that the AR target values is basically done across all regional boards with state board participation so that we don't end up with different AR target values unless it's justified for the same crop in different regional boards. I mean, there would be legitimate cases where there would be different and there would be others where they would have just been a different process and came out with a different answer without a justification. So that one we combine together to attempt to make sure that that is coordinated.
So it sounds like the first of those two will be basically done on the regional level, and the second will be a process that the state's kind of going to drive and involve the regions in?
Yes, I think the state participates. I use it more as an equal participation with the regional boards and the state board, but the state board would be the convener and try to help manage that in such a way that it's across the regional boards.
So I have a question that all of this kind of brings to mind. We're really concerned about how much nitrogen goes down. And we seem to be trying to get at that question in this roundabout way with coming up with estimates of these ratios, and it's either A over R or A minus R. And I'm just wondering, what has been the discussion about using nitrogen soil probes at the depth of the root zone?
Yeah,
that we would have data instead of these estimates and ranges.
So there's a bunch of difficulty with that. I will put on my ag engineering degree hat for that and admit that I was one of those students years ago that went around trying to do those measurements. And there's a fundamental rule we always deal with soil eventually come to realize, and that's that it's so variable when you take a couple steps to a different site that where do you put the probe? How deep should it be? And that changes on crops and soil types and that kind of stuff. So direct measurement becomes worse because the data you get from that is so hard to read that it really has almost limited value. And you have to control for all these different environmental conditions. And so you end up with 2 pages of precedential or kind of like the description of this result only applies in this field during this year, growing this crop, with this EC of irrigation water, and you end up with, you know, it becomes hard to broadly apply it. So the expert panel then, you know, understanding that, tries to apply the concept of this indirect measurement. It is indirect, but it is a good proxy for what you're losing at the bottom. It's not a direct measurement, but it's not as close as we think we can get to being to do it on a broad scale, which is where it counts, rather than at a point. So region 5 was headed down the path of trying to say, well, we're going to do these measurements in a couple select fields. And then we would presume that it is, you know, any field, any almond crop, you know, somewhat similar soils will have the same effect. But the trouble with that is well, it depends on whether that farmer's got drip irrigation, flood irrigation, sprinklers, whether he's on an irrigation system that gives him 21-day cycles and he doesn't have a choice, or he's irrigating to demand. And so it really starts to crumble down. It really is hard to get at that. So while we would love to have the direct measurement, it has not been shown to be in the cards yet. The one thing that I did track down and we tried to look at was there are some instances where you can bury these polymer bags in the bottom of your field, and they collect the nitrogens that put by over a period of time. And so you can take them out, and then you can say, well, so much flux of nitrogen went below, but you're still stuck with, it was that one spot. You disturbed the soil when you dug the hole to put it in, which changed how much water flux through that, so it now becomes start to be invalid as did that really represent the whole field or not, and you get right back to kind of some of the same problems. So, not that we really want to go there, but we haven't been able to find a way.
Well, but is this a result of us thinking and guessing that it wouldn't work, or has it been shown to be through testing that it really is more complicated and problematic than we think it might be?
Well, I would contend it's through several decades of academic research along the lines, and now I'm trying to digest that along with the ag expert panels, also looking at that and saying what they could really yield from it. But I think there's some anomaly too. So then you say, well, let's measure every field. Well, there's 40,000 farmers in the Central Valley, and you know how many fields are there, and the millions of acres you get to it. And it gets really complex in the data sets that you're looking at, and you actually lose focus because of the data. It's a very common thing. I'm sorry, I'm making a slight soapbox, but oftentimes people are like, well, let's just put a soil sensor in for a moisture sensor in the field. And me as a practitioner years ago decided that was actually dangerous in many instances because, again, it's that one point. And I challenge anybody to tell me the exact perfect point of any field where that one soil sensor ought to be placed. So then the answer is, we'll put 5 or 10 and get a statistical number. Well, you put 5 or 10, and now you start getting some really erroneous data. Two of them get bad and give you a really bad number. Do you throw those out? Do you keep them? And so you get measurements on a broad scale that, you know, when you're trying to measure a field that you're looking at a point, gets to be a problem. Now, there are some very interesting technologies coming along that I like personally. They're like when they measure from satellites and they look at evapotranspiration on a whole field from infrared imagery. And they're actually getting some pretty interesting results there. Well, they can now tell you the evapotranspiration from the field. I'm sorry, I digressed a bit into your questioning. It's a fascinating subject. We should talk about it a lot later.
We should hear what you have to say about it. I have to admit to you that you haven't really convinced me.
I can tell.
Yeah.
No. Well, and I'm going to say, as a vasostone hydrogeologist with quite a bit of experience in unsaturated zone flow, the jury's still out on this issue. I think we also have to afford technology the opportunity here, too. You know, I'm going to steal from the chair's line of innovation. Darren is actually starting to hit on it, that through time we actually may be able to get closer and closer proxies to the real flux beneath the root zone. I anticipate that'll happen. And I don't think it can be done as a ubiquitous answer either. I don't think it applies to every field, even now in time.
All right, well, I mean, I don't want to get into a a further discussion about this, but I think that there's ways that can be, I think, gotten around some of the concerns that you've raised, you know, Darren, with this. And I would hope that technology is going to help us, I think, do a better job down the line with all of this, because I get uncomfortable when we start coming up with proxies. You know, it's like we've used proxies for determining when baby waters are acceptable to bathe in. You know, we, the coliform bacteria is a proxy for the true health effect of bathing or consuming, you know, shellfish. And so we've known over time that it wasn't, it was a good proxy, but we continue to refine it and have added suites of other indicator organisms to fine-tune it. So I hope we go beyond this, because I just kind of feel just uncomfortable with this. That's just my comment. So, you know, we can go deeper in the root zone. I mean, you could go down to an area where it's not going to be dependent on a crop. But we identify where the water table is, and we say, you know, at that distance down, if we're getting nitrogen coming down, that's going to be problematic. And then we can get away with everything going on up above in that first, you know, couple of feet.
Yeah, I don't disagree from an ideal standpoint, and hopefully we can get to that at some stage. But
yeah,
it doesn't present itself presently.
Yeah. Thank you.
The next set of requirements in the order after the nitrogen management requirements is the sampling of on-farm drinking water supply wells. So there is an existing program in the Central Coast for this. The East San Joaquin order establishes the requirements statewide, and there are a particular set of sampling schedule that the East San Joaquin order sets out, but it does allow the regional board some flexibility in determining what the schedule should be. The precedential requirement is limited to sampling for nitrates, but the regional water boards are given some flexibility to determine if they want sampling for additional constituents in order. And there is a requirement for all statewide for the notification to be provided by a grower if to the drinkers of the water if the sample exceeds the relevant health standards. Other precedential requirements in the order, and I'll talk about these very quickly, but all growers under the statewide precedent will be participating in outreach efforts and training. That's also something that came from the Agricultural Expert Panel recommendations, that there be training and outreach for everyone, not just based on tiers or vulnerability. All growers must report management practices. There's a significant amount of discretion there for the regional boards to determine the schedule for that reporting, but the management practices need to be reported under the precedential requirements. And then growers with potential to discharge sediment that may degrade surface waters must implement sediment and erosion control practices. Again, the regional board has a fair amount of discretion as to what format if a plan is going to be required, if reporting is required, but the requirement to actually implement the practices is precedential. Water quality monitoring, the order continues, as all of our orders have, to require surface water monitoring and groundwater quality trend monitoring. The particular surface water monitoring provisions of the East San Joaquin order, I think this might be a little misleading, actually, the way I phrase it. This particular requirements of the East San Joaquin order are not precedential for all regional boards, but the requirement to conduct surface water monitoring is precedential. And then with the groundwater quality trend monitoring, again, significant discretion is left to the regional boards as to the constituents and the specific requirements that are to be carried out. One thing I did want to mention is that the order does have a section on anti-degradation. Yep.
Can you go back to the previous slide? Last sentence left specific requirements and monitor constituents left to the discretion. Okay, so that applies strictly to the monitoring, not to the practices.
Since we're
not, as a regional board, we don't have the authority to dictate agriculture practices.
Right. This is about the monitoring and the specific constituents and the specific schedule of monitoring that the regional board is going to require. It's just to clarify that some groundwater trend monitoring does need to be part of any irrigated lands program, as well as surface water monitoring. Anti-degradation was an issue that was raised by petitioners, and the order does address the anti-degradation findings of the East San Joaquin order and finds them to be appropriate. The question here was how you conduct an anti-degradation analysis in the non-point source context where you have, you know, a diffuse set of discharges, multiple water bodies, multiple contaminants that you need to address. And the order states that the way in which the Central Valley Board made the findings in the East San Joaquin order, which are fairly generalized, was appropriate in the context of this kind of non-point source landscape-based discharge. But the order also states that the considerations of what's in the maximum benefit of the people and what constitutes best practical treatment or control, that analysis needs to continue to evolve because obviously our understanding of the impacts of water quality and the methods to control is advancing. And so that should not be a static analysis and should continue to evolve. So going forward, a couple of things. The State Water Board Division of Water Quality is preparing FAQs and reaching out to the regional water boards to assist with implementation of this order. It's also important, I wanted to point out, that there are three lawsuits that have been filed on the order, and those will be proceeding through the courts, primarily challenging the order's compliance with the non-point source policy and the anti-degradation policy. They raise slightly different issues. They're all filed by environmental parties, and the issues vary somewhat. I think one is specific to anti-degradation. One really focuses on the non-point source policy and the idea of the feedback mechanism and whether the feedback mechanism is sufficient. Public trust is raised, maybe in two out of three. They're also against different parties. So the state board only is the party in one of them, and I think it's State Board and the Central Valley Board in two. So, but it's likely that the court is holding a hearing to consider whether those should be consolidated. So, one significant aspect of the State Board order is that it is looking forward to how implementation is going to proceed, and in particularly how water quality is going to be improved. Specifically, the State Board has asked or has directed the regional boards in this order to report back on a triennial basis to the State Board on a number of issues. Progress on the precedential aspects of the order, are they being implemented, and what are the water quality results as a result of that implementation? Progress on enrollment of non-filers, the State Board made it clear in the order that the regional board should be working on making sure that non-filers are enrolled out of concerns with fairness and equity. And then finally, progress on outreach for management practice implementation. So here the State Board has a discussion about coalitions versus direct regulation and whether, this is the graph I had shown at the beginning, you know, we have the feedback mechanism of the monitoring and reporting to inform on the water quality outcomes, but then if the requirements for water quality are not being met, there needs to be a loop back to make sure that appropriate improved management practices are going into place. Yes.
So I just want to be clear that I'm understanding progress on outreach versus progress on regional boards determining what management practices are being implemented. Because I think I may have either misheard you or what I heard in several points of your presentation, your description of regional boards becoming more engaged with determining what those best management practices are. And I think that's a line that we don't have that authority. What we have is the ability to require monitoring with the ability to show where compliance and non-compliance is occurring. But we cannot dictate what the practices are. And so that's, I just want to be clear that that's what that progress report is about.
Yeah, so I think the way I would describe it is that the regional board can't dictate the management practices, but the regional board can, or depending on the structure of the permit, if it's direct regulation, the regional board staff, if it's coalition, the coalition would carry out these functions. The regional board can reach out to growers who, for some reason, look like they're outliers on nitrogen application and give out training, for example, on a slew of management practices that have been shown to help with reducing the amount of nitrogen that might be escaping the root zone. So it's that type of outreach that we have in mind. And one of the things I think that the order states is that, you know, there are obviously different models for how to approach this kind of regulation. We have a couple of different models currently in the state with direct regulation and coalition-based regulation. There might be regional differences. There might be differences in terms of the number of growers that are regulated that dictate those types of differences. But I think State Board would like, is interested in hearing back from the regional boards as to whether there's a difference in terms of how successful the outreach is and how many resources are available for outreach under the different models.
The really results will only happen here if we can convince growers to modify their practices, as within almost all the non-point stuff we do. And that avenue of how you're going to reach out to them is a central question as to the success of the program. Obviously, the Central Valley has chosen a coalition approach where they are, you know, utilizing a third party that's self-funding, that has a lot of ability to interact with the farmers. They have, you know, they're not a regulator, so they can, you know, get first practitioners and have communication on a different scale. That obviously is different in a context where the regional board's the direct regulator, and so then there's going to have to be different methods found of how to identify that, get those communications out, and approach that, certainly. Because ultimately, just tracking the progress, or it will help some make those modifications. If we want it faster, we have to have the education component that's always there in a non-point source component.
So, and I don't have this on the slide, but another aspect of the reporting back is whether under the coalition structure, the way in which it has been set up with reporting through the coalition is also yielding the water quality results that are expected. So both aspects are something that the state board is expecting to hear back on. Talked about that, and I think that brings us to the end of our presentation. We're happy to answer questions.
So you can ask some questions. We also have speaker cards on this particular topic, which may generate additional questions from our board. So what's your pleasure? Do you have any question at this time? We wait? Okay. So first speaker card is Carrie Ellis, and there'll be 3 minutes, please.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Kaylee Ellis, and I'm speaking on behalf of Claire Weinman and the Growership Association of Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo Counties. We are very interested in the implementation of the presidential aspects of the State Water Board's review of the Eastern San Joaquin Order on the Central Coast. We are especially interested and will continue to be actively engaged on how to incentivize the utilization of high nitrate groundwater. We will also be particularly impacted by the treatment of total nitrogen applied and removed reporting for our diverse specialty crop growers with multiple plantings throughout the year. In all of the requirements, it is our hope that the requirements will balance the benefit of reporting with the burden and focus on our shared goal of improving water quality. We look forward to actively engaging with the Water Board in the development of the succeeding irrigated lands regulatory program. Thank you.
Thank you. Next, Mr. Schimmick.
I was still writing when you called me up, but that's the way it is. Steve Schimmick, the Outer Projects in Monterey Coast Keeper. One of the things that I wanted to point out is that these are discharge permits, a permit linking a person to a discharge, not a field to a discharge, not a township to a discharge, not a set of aggregated data to a discharge, a person, an operator to a discharger. These are discharger permits. One of the things that I want to point out is that for the field on the East San Joaquin, they're doing three-year running average or rotation of running average, and this will demonstrate my point. What you've got in the Central Coast is you've got perhaps a strawberry grower. That grower is not the owner of the field. He's a grower of strawberries. He will be there 1 year, maybe two. Then the next year, there will be a different grower of broccoli or cauliflower or lettuce. Totally different person. And it may not be the same year to year. So if you start rotating things and averaging things, you have immediately lost that linkage between the discharge and the person. You're now talking about a field that is carrying a bunch of crops. And no one has ever been able to explain how that works. They also, in East San Joaquin, allow aggregation of data. They also allow reporting by a unit area. What's mentioned in the order often is on the township level. Townships are squares, not related to watersheds. There's also anonymity of data, which has been tested in the courts on the Central Coast. And it's also a coalition approach to actually the collection of the data, the aggregation of the data. And it's, again, there's this wall that is penetrable, but very difficult to put everything together, especially for the public, especially for the public. Then there's people. So that's what's happening out in the field, right? And the data that we're getting back. Then there's the people. What are the people responsible for? They're never responsible for their discharge. They're responsible for signing up, attending classes, reporting practices, creating plans. They're never responsible for their discharge. Then there's all these things that lead to delay. There's the removed versus, there's applied versus removed. There have been decades of doing applied versus crop uptake values. We're going to throw that out, and we're going to start over with removed. How about if the crop has prunings? How about if the crop has, like, strawberries where the plants are removed and trucked away? They're never weighed. They're never anything. They're just trucked away. So, look, and then in the order in the East San Joaquin, there's process for everything. They develop values for crop nitrogen removed. Then there has to be a process for the public to vet it. There's determining the range of acceptable applications. Then there's a public process. There's determining what's an outlier. And then finally, the order actually says in one place, if we decide that any regulation is necessary, there will be a public process. Look, water is in bad shape. It's in bad shape now. It will be in worse shape with this order years from now. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. Next, Abby Taylor Silva. And then after that will be Kay Mercer.
So thank you to Emil and Darren for attending and speaking today. We, with GrowShipper and our partners, have been really studying the San Joaquin Order. We've had many conversations with them before the order was adopted and since, and we just really appreciate their taking the time to help everyone understand it. So the order allows for the regional board to have some discretion for an alternate reporting area. You've heard about this a couple of times today, and that's up to 640 acres. We felt this was a really important element of the East San Joaquin. It was something that we'd really like to work with you and your staff on. This was added due to the complexities of Central Coast growing. As you're aware, our members might grow multiple crops on a ranch, many multiple crops on a ranch, sometimes a crop on a fraction of an acre. And this alternate reporting area really came about after we had multiple conversations with staff and board members just about those distinctions and how distinct the attributes of growing the crops on the Central Coast are versus a more permanent crop on the Central Valley on a larger acreage block. So we really hope and encourage you to be open-minded to alternative reporting ideas, and I think they'll still get you the information that you need and are required to have under this order, but it could allow for reporting systems that are really fine-tuned to the farming systems on the Central Coast. Additionally, the East San Joaquin Order must be implemented within 5 years. That's in your staff report. We know that you've set an early deadline on Ag Waiver 3.0 renewal into 4.0, but I just want to clarify and note that if you maintain that you'd like to adopt a new order in 2020, you could adopt one that phases in these requirements. That is an option. You still have the 5 years. In our conversations with State Water Board staff and board members, we really, especially with board members, we heard time and again, they were trying to find a balance that gets the water boards the information that they need, but not simply ask for more data for data's sake. And I think it should be recognized, this order is really asking for a lot of new data, a lot of new information, much more reporting by growers of all types of sizes. In the order, it specifically says we will proceed cautiously at this time and not require more information than we find is necessary to effectively manage the irrigated lands regulatory program and provide the public with the essential assurance that we're doing so. As a regulatory entity, we are cognizant that we should be judicious in exercising our regulatory authority only as necessary by only collecting the information we believe is necessary to fulfill our mandates. We're just hoping the Central Coast Regional Board will take a similar tactic and really looking at implementing requirements in a way that incorporates these new requirements from the East San Joaquin and our regulations, and allowing ourselves some time to work with the regulated entities and your board to build an order that really addresses cropping and farming on the Central Coast. Thank you.
Thank you. And Ms. Mercer.
Hello, I'm Kay Mercer with KMI, and I am, we'll begin, and if I have time, I'll make some comments, but I'm going to begin with some comments that have been asked to read into the record by Joel Wiley. He's the CCA in the Salinas area, and he serves on the Board of Certified Crop Advisors, and I'll put in a plug for Joel. He's probably knows more about Central Coast crop nutrition than just about anyone on the Central Coast. He's been a CCA since 1992, which had to be when the program first started. and he's been involved with many programs to educate growers on the Central Coast. He's concerned that one day he may be targeted by individuals or groups because of his work. There's been ongoing question about indemnification and hold harmless clauses and the language that was put into the East San Joaquin order, and there's question about whether that language will be fully adopted in the Ag Waiver 4.0. He requests that the Central Coast Water Board adopt wording from the East San Joaquin order that addresses the indemnification of CCAs or other third-party service providers. He feels it's critical that it be adopted and that the wording be used from the order. Based upon recent staff action with Tier 3 growers, it is very important to me, to Joel, that this staff undervalues the support and educational outreach that CCAs can provide. Joel goes on to say, I know that there are many CCAs that are interested in supporting the growers they work with. A hold harmless clause is critical to ensure that CCAs and third parties get the protection they deserve, especially when they are helping growers comply at the request of this water board. Joel says, I would request that the Central Coast Water Board investigate the adoption of the wording that goes beyond indemnification to a clause that holds CCAs and other third parties hold harmless. I talked to Joel this morning trying to get better understanding of what he's asking for. Joel is very concerned that he's not going to be able to get insurance, or other parties will not be able to get insurance if the Water Board does not adopt language that allows that to happen. So that's the end of his comments. On my comments, I want to thank Emil and Darren for all the work that they did and for working with us throughout pretty much the whole holiday season to come up to make modifications that fit the Central Coast. Some of the things that, as I listened to their presentation, there is a lot of discretion in the presidential requirements for this water board. I'm very concerned that discretion may not be executed in a reasonable manner. I also am concerned that there is a lack of incentives in both the East San Joaquin order and in the current Ag Waiver 3.0. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. This time, I would like to start on my left. You ask your questions, and then on my right, and then we can wrap up. So, Mayor Delgado, your turn.
Okay, thank you. My question regards the use of nitrogen data and regarding our board's approval of groundwater protection targets for nitrogen loading and our board's evaluation of the nitrogen data to be within acceptable ranges of applied and removed ratio targets. My question is, if the targets aren't met for nitrogen loading or the targets aren't met for acceptable ranges of applied and removed ratios, what does the East San Joaquin order suggest happen if in those cases?
So at this point, the East San Joaquin order is setting up a process for determination of what those targets should be, and as well as what the consequences should be. Are they targets? Are they some kind of limits? None of that actually has been specifically determined. With regard to the data we currently have and will currently be receiving, such as the nitrogen, the A over R ratio before the development of targets, that triggers under the order two things. So an outlier for the A over R ratio would have to get additional training to self-certify or have professional certification. That's one, and it also triggers requirements for the coalition to actually follow up with the grower on and to consider management practices. So currently those are the consequences for the AR data. how the AR ranges and values will be actually used and interpreted has been left kind of to the process of developing them. And similarly with the groundwater protection targets, whether or not, how precisely so those will be used once they're developed. They're intended to be an expression of what level of loading is required to be consistent with meeting the receiving water limitations for the area, but we haven't, I don't think the process has considered exactly how that would be implemented and what the consequences would be if that loading target is not being met. That one is a collective target, right? It applies to a whole township or alternative geographic area. So part of the consideration is how you then apportion any kind of consequences from not meeting them.
So what I would be concerned of looking far ahead would be if we set targets and they're not met, what time does it take between setting the targets and finding out that they're not met? And then let's say when we do find out they're not met, then the requirement is to self-certify. And then the time it would take after that self-certification to find out if then the targets are met the next round, and then if it wasn't met the next round, must they have a third-party certification help them along or implement a new management practice? And then the amount of time it might take for that new management practice to be assessed as to whether now the new target or the acceptable target is met. So in the future, not today, but in the development of 4.0, I hope that we as a board can understand how that process might play out, because I think I heard both perspectives of the growers and the environmentalists today say, basically, you know, we don't want to collect data to collect data. We want to collect data that's going to be usable to improve water quality. So those are my comments. Thank you.
Yeah, that's something.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, Ms. Gray?
Thanks. Yeah, I don't have any questions. I just, you know, have some comments. And, yeah, I think collapsing time frames when time is not on our side. So getting, you know, incentives and changing behavior so that we are able to address nitrate issues as we recognize them, I think is really helpful to some of the points that you raised. And then secondly, with determination of ARs and A over R and A minus R and all of that, I mean, I'm just hopeful that we're using the advanced technology that we do have. I mean, we're dealing with nature, which is a highly complicated system, and I understand all the site specificity, you know, that we have in our regions. But we have identified problems, and we have identified trends, and so to the extent that we can deploy the best use of technology, satellite imagery and others, I think we need to do that. We have a huge issue. It's not getting any better. It's just getting exacerbated, and the more protracted it becomes, and the worse it is. So those are just my statements.
So back on my topic, just for a short bit, the development of the ratios, is that going to be done with any eye towards what's actually happening in the aquifer with respect to nitrate and nitrogen levels?
That's actually the groundwater protection targets would be that component. The ratios are really looking at what's doable in a set of conditions that include the crop, the field, the soil type, the irrigation, and an expectation as to, you know, from the agronomic knowledge we have now, what would we expect to be a good number or a range of numbers by which we would expect someone to hit. I suspect that many AR ratios that we find for certain crops will show that AR ratio, if it was across an entire broad area, would not meet water quality standards. I mean, we kind of know that because our water is contaminated with nitrates now. The question is how good can we get that, and then what do we learn from that exercise? Because, you know, there's certainly room to be better. I think just even looking at the data of the applied collected on the Central Coast from your guys' previous collection of data, I mean, it was a big step from the first year to the second year in amount of nitrogen applied, and certainly a reduction in amount. One could presume that a reduction in the amount of nitrogen applied you know, is yielding itself and less lost nitrogen. So that, you know, we're already seeing some progress, but it's a good question that we all want to know. We're going to have to collect some data to get there to see whether, you know, and then what the mix of crops are and other things that might then yield themselves in a groundwater protection target zone to actually achieve water quality.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Can you just run over for me one more time the precedential provisions made in East San Joaquin regarding liability of certifiers?
Sure. So I can actually provide, let me provide the particular footnote and page number. Just to look at it, if I can find it very quickly. I think it's footnote 101. I'll look for it. Actually, here it is. Page 38 of attachment B has the specific language, and footnote 103 on page 36 of the order explains the reasoning behind the language. And it establishes several things. One is that the certifier can rely on the data that the grower is providing. Two, that if any water quality impacts are due to incorrect implementation of the certifier's recommendations, that the certifier is not liable. Three, that essentially the standard that the certifier is being held to is one of meeting the agronomic needs of the crop while minimizing the potential for discharge to groundwater, so that the focus is on their expertise, which is really about the agronomic needs of the crop. And finally, and I think this is really for purposes of making sure that insurance is available, a statement that the certification does not create an environmental liability for the certifier.
And I heard some concern expressed, hopeful that that this region would adopt the language in the East San Joaquin order. And what I take from your presentation is that in fact, we would be required to.
Yeah, that specific language is precedential.
Thank you.
Thank you. And my question actually was covered by Mr. Delgado, so. I appreciate exploring that, and so I would just add a couple comments, and I think I am relieved to know that in our region, because we have such small scale growers, probably much greater number than you would find in the East San Joaquin Valley, that we have some discussions and flexibility to deal with the low-income farmers or small-scale acreage or lease crop growers that are operating on leases, because I think we're going to need to really pay attention to that. Even the comment about advanced technology moving us closer to the ability to be more accurate in our measurements, those involve cost factors that are well beyond really marginal growers that are operating on the edge. So those are things that I'm glad to hear that we have that discussion. I support, of course, overall the direction we need to go in. But I also want to be sure that those resources and incentives that some of the larger scale farmers can take advantage of and can also, to some degree, observe the risks of making these changes, and that the smaller scale farmers are going to need more time to take a more established path as opposed to exploring and discovering what works and what doesn't work. They wouldn't last you know, 3 years. They would not make it in that scenario. So, you know, I'll be looking to staff for at least describing and acknowledging where that latitude exists and how, and specifically, you know, what the timelines and what the exemptions are going to allow for, because we won't let them sit out, you know, in a long-term sense, but we certainly want to have them on, have the timeline in mind that's more, that is reasonable for the low-income farmers and really small-scale operators. So that would be my main concern.
So thank you, my colleagues, for your questions and comments. You know, couple of areas for me. One, dovetail a little bit on Mr. Johnson's question about identification and whole harmless clause. You know, you have two tier. You have the third party certifier, and you have a self certifier. Does this whole harmless clause apply to both?
There's specific language for the self certifier, and I actually have it here, and let me take a look very quickly. I'll try to answer your question. Find it. It's a variation on the language for the professional certifier, and it's not quite as specific, but it states that you know, and actually, so I think the way it works is that it's the same certification for both, except that it clarifies that if the certifier is not the member, then the member is allowed to rely on the information and data provided by the member. Then the certifier is allowed to rely on it. And then also the clause that says the person used the sound irrigation nitrogen management planning practices in accordance with their specialization would not apply in that case. So I'll take a look at it and maybe get back to you on exactly
what that case is. Yeah, if you can clarify, because, you know, bottom line, if you have a third-party certifier and that particular individual, you know, is held harmless from, you know, environmental damage, the self-certifier, in a sense, should fit in the same category. Otherwise, what you do, you hire your third party because de facto it becomes your insurance policy. So,
On a very quick review, that is what this affects essentially. There are just two things that drop out, two sentences that say where the person signing the INMP is not
right.
The member. He, she may rely on the information and data provided by the member is not required to independently verify. So in that case, the member is actually certifying that they are providing information that, to the best of their knowledge, is true. So they sign a separate statement saying that. And also where the person signing the INMP is not the member, the clause about he or she not being responsible for damage or loss arising out of the subsequent implementation drops out. So, but other than those two dropping out, the idea that it doesn't create environmental liability stays in, and the there's still a standard that suggests that it's the agronomic rate that they're applying while minimizing discharge
mm-hmm.
to groundwater as opposed to an actual environmental determination as to what the minimization should be.
Okay, because, you know, Dr. Hunter, you know, made a good additional comment
mm-hmm.
is that for, you know, small growers who are, you know, razor thin, they cannot necessarily afford having to hire a third party in order to get that, you know, shelter from liability. So there is an issue of fairness to on both sides. So
I'm pretty sure what I just said is accurate, so
okay.
It can apply to them. But I'll read it carefully outside of this too.
Thank you. Then lastly, you know, a little bit back to technology and Mr. Young. the issue of nitrogen application, nitrogen removed, has, there are multiple ways of addressing sometimes the measurements. You know, earlier it was felt like, oh my God, we're in the dark age. We have no idea what the heck is going on. Well, I don't think that's exactly correct because, for example, in a lot of farming operations, you will do soil pits and soil tests. Now, you may argue and say, oh my goodness, you know, 100 acres, not uniform. Well, you do three soil pits, and then you look at, you know, the constituents in the soil, and you use that for your analysis of soil amendments. So that's one example. In terms of nitrate intake in plants, well, a lot of agriculturists do that already, petiole analysis. You know, you take the leaf, petiole sample, you send it to the lab, it'll tell you what you have, and you use that for your fertilizer, you know, dosage and type of fertilizer applied. You know, we're talking about soil analysis. You know, it's one here, one there. It's not very accurate. Well, we're way beyond that. You know, we do soil moisture sensor analysis. We have what's called the vacuum chamber, which, or sometimes the name is the pressure bomb, and that's used where you actually extract the moisture content of the leaf, and that gives you a pretty darn accurate piece of information in terms of your water regimen. You know, other examples in soil and moisture analysis is a fairly new technology, which is geophysics, you know, using soil resistivity. And that is applied. Cal Poly is doing several, San Luis Obispo is doing several demonstrations on that. So I would dislike to end this, you know, thinking this, oh, you know, we're in this middle age. I don't think we are. You know, we certainly have progress we can make, and I think that's going to be the job, and I would even call it the duty of our farmers, you know, out here in the room to help bring to this board, hey, these are other type of technologies that we are applying. I was, yesterday, I was sharing with our executive officer, Mr. Robertson, the newly released data from UC Davis. They just published a 2017 national study on high technology expenditure in food and agriculture. You know, the state of California, 2017, food and ag spent $2.2 billion, with a B, in high technology investments. And that relates to some of the things I just talked about, to, you know, smart machines, applying, you know, in artificial intelligence, robotics, biotechnology, etc. Later on, we're going to hear about the Healthy Soil Initiatives, etc. That's another good example on how we can address a little bit how we reduce, you know, nitrate leaching into our groundwater. So I just wanted to bring this little positive sliver here, you know, to help our colleagues there in the room, you know, bring to us some of these great ideas that you have and research projects that you have in your individual commodities to help us, you know, see, okay, there's light at the end of the tunnel here. So anyway, I just wanted to make that quick personal observation. Yes, Mayor Delgado.
Well, I appreciate you talking about progress that could be made, and all the spending of money, I'm sure, is leading to progress made. And it reminds me of the public comment about the urging for incentives. And I wonder, Chair, if you know or staff knows of incentive examples that have been employed in the past or have been suggested to be employed in the future, so that if if there is progress made toward targets, or there is progress made experimenting with high technology, that, you know, what can we, what's being discussed as potential incentive options?
Well, some that I indirectly I could think of indirectly come from the Farm Bill. And, for example, the NRCS does provide grant funding and includes VRCDs for irrigation efficiency monitoring. In fact, in San Luis Obispo County, you can get it done for free right now. And that has some component, you know, associated with irrigation efficiency, because if you have a very inefficient uniformity of irrigation, you know, your applied fertilizer is going to be all over the map. So that would be one example. I know there are different, CDFA has quite a few grant programs that they have provided. Now, the challenge is, you know, as an individual grower, it's not very easy to apply for those grants. First, you got to know where they are. You have to know how to write grants. So, you know, usually this is where some organizations such as VRCDs, VNRCS, you know, and universities tend to be a little more efficient on how to do that. But there's some funding. I just gave you a couple of examples. I have to say that the $2.7 billion is investment directly from the industry. So this is not money coming from, you know, the state or federal sources.
Right, so I was thinking of putting the money in to that extent and probably getting something out of it. But I don't know if they're getting any rewards. I'm sure a lot of investment goes awry, doesn't work out. I wonder if staff has had discussions with growers regarding specific ideas of incentives.
Well, I personally think that, you know, incentive makes it a win-win. You know, a win for the environment and a win for the grower. If, you know, we can incentivize growers to improve their practices, to improve water quality, you know, there's no question about it. I mean, I know there has been discussion of incentives through sustainability certification program. That's perhaps one example. So anyway, that's, do you have any input on that?
Well, I'm going to reflect to Kaylee Ellis, who is speaking on behalf of Claire, brought up a point that Claire regularly brings up, is how to incent use of nitrogen-rich water. I'll call it nitrogen-rich water. But how to scavenge, or how to incentivize scavenging of nitrogen out of water, you know, ag supply water. That's something that we've put a lot of thought to at the staff level. And we'll talk more about with on the September item.
Has there ever been discussion of certain monitoring elements that are required on a yearly basis that could be relaxed to some degree if a particular submitter of monitoring results was showing, you know, a positive trend or a regular trend of compliance, such that maybe their requirement for monitoring could be relaxed? Has that ever been vetted?
I think we're diving in a little to the debate of 4.0 right now, and I don't want to, you know, we didn't agenda
that.
And then stuff that we think about, yeah.
Was any of that vetted in the East San Joaquin Valley process, incentives?
I'm not coming to mind. I mean, there certainly is the incentive to participate in the coalition, you know, and get benefit from that aspect of the way they've set up their structure. But as far as a direct individual grower benefit from the East San Joaquin order, I'm not reflecting any at the moment.
So the growers weren't offering up ideas or urging the inclusion of incentive language in the order?
I think there were some that were occasionally mentioned, but, you know, we took the order from the Central Valley Board. And I will admit that I'm not fully, you know, was not part of all of those conversations that they did, obviously, which is why I was able to do the petition. So I would hesitate to say that there wasn't discussions about it, but certainly there wasn't a lot of contemplated about it in the context of the petition review.
Right, that makes sense. Thank you. So I'd like to wrap up this item. I think Dr. Hunter has one more question or comment.
Yeah, for Mr. Robertson. Can you remind me of the workshops that are coming up on the ag order? We have some coming up in the summer, right? Chris, thank you, Chris.
Chris Rose with the Youth Ledger Return Program. The next time we have a discussion on AGRA 4.0 will be at the September board meeting. Right, and we'll be having individual discussions with grower advocates and with the board leading up to September. But in September, that's the rollout of our draft requirements, options for the board and the public, and for the public and advocates from our parties to take a look at those draft requirements and provide public written comment.
So, and I think subsequent to the rollout, we'll also have some fall outreach efforts.
Subsequent or after? Yes, that is correct. And we'll have workshops after that.
After September.
Other workshops after, yeah. So we'll release information, and then we're going to sort of go on the road with it, so to speak.
Okay. And I'm guessing you'll follow our usual pattern of one in the north, one in the south.
Probably at least three, maybe four. Mm-hmm. That's kind of been our norm lately, is three or four.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. One online and different ways.
Yeah,
we typically are doing that as well. Now we're using Skype, but we'll also do in-person workshops, and we typically do something in San Luis Obispo, Watsonville, San Luis Obispo. Mm-hmm. We're invited to farm bureaus and, mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. I just wanted to refresh my memory.
Sure.
I knew those were all in the calendar.
They're in the queue?
Yep. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So this wraps up this item 11, and we'll take a 15-minute break. We convene at 3:45 for the next item. Thank you.